Accession number 18089, Reel 3.
Like the Valiant, the Vulcan II was then principally employed as a high-level nuclear bomber, equipped with later-generation British weapons. Within the armoury, I think I can safely say now, in addition to the Blue Danube, which I've referred to already, a weapon called the Red Beard, which was certainly carried by the Canberra.
Was that free-falling as well?
Yes, it was. Yellow Sun, which came in two versions, the Mark I and the Mark II, and these were all free-falling weapons. The retarded weapon didn't come till rather later, and perhaps I could return to that. But whilst it was primarily equipped or capable of carrying these nuclear weapons, or weapons from that range, it was still equipped in 1962 with the old-fashioned iron bombs, and the Vulcan carried 21 of these. The Victor, incidentally, carried 35, the Vulcan 21. Now, mostly, we trained with scaled-down dummies called practice bombs. At that time, they were weighing 28 pounds. There was also a 100-pounder, I believe. But just now and then, we were required to train with the real thing, and indeed to release them. And this exercise was usually conducted on the desert range at El Adam in Libya. And it's no exaggeration to say that the aircraft did lurch somewhat as 9.5 tons of bombs fell away simultaneously. But just occasionally they didn't all fall away cleanly, and that presented a potential headache to the crew, as of course there was a risk of detonation as the aircraft descended through the altitude at which the fuse had been set to prime. Now, there was a theoretical solution to this problem. If you had perhaps an armed weapon in the bomb bay, you didn't want to descend below that height, so you would look for a high-level airfield. Well, there are only a couple in the world, if I can think of, that might have fitted that bill. One was perhaps Nairobi in Kenya. The other was La Paz in Bolivia, elevation of about 5,000 feet. So a far more practical approach was to maneuver violently over the sea with the bomb doors open and hope to shake the hang-up away and into the water harmlessly, one would hope.
Wasn't it doubly primed, though? It was primed to explode on impact, wasn't it?
There were a variety of fuse settings, and these were perhaps belt and braces, but more safety. You had to have a double priming. So if that priming hadn't operated, there would have been a ground one. But there was also, I don't know whether they were in series or parallel, because we're getting into a technical area now. There were other devices for priming a weapon operated by a little fan on the nose as it went down, of course. But I know there was a setting which we used to treat with some respect if we had a hang-up. Perhaps I haven't got the whole story. That notwithstanding, our primary role was as part of the UK's nuclear deterrent, our national nuclear deterrent, initially at high level, but ultimately at low level. Indeed, I'll use the phrase now, ultra-low level, which perhaps I could define later on. And this change came about very, very soon after Gary Powers, U2, was shot down by a Soviet ground-to-air missile. It was realised, of course, it didn't take a thinking man to appreciate this, that we were very vulnerable because we were flying somewhat higher than the Valiant. In fact, the Vulcan could reach a height of 49,000 feet over the target. It was still vulnerable because Gary Powers was considerably in excess of that when he was shot down. So low level was then on the menu. Excuse me. All of the V-bombers were originally finished in a white high-gloss anti-radiation paint, but of course with the switch to low level, a dark green camouflage paint was introduced to the upper surfaces. But of course the boffins had quite failed to appreciate that to a fighter loitering above, we now stood out like the proverbial sore thumb when flying over perhaps the snow-covered terrain of northern Europe. and the Soviet Union, which was our presumed hunting ground. Nor at low level could we use the blackout curtains that had previously been zipped up. There was a blackout curtain right across the whole of the pilot's windscreen canopy. And there are also little side shutters to put over the side portholes. But of course,
against flash, or?
Against nuclear flash, that's absolutely right. So we couldn't use these at low level. We needed to look out to make sure we weren't going to fly into anything. And so we were issued with, and were required to wear on operations, a standard black medical eye patch. And in the event of being blinded, we were to lift it up, switch it over, and put it on the other eye. Not very scientific, was it? And certainly not very comforting. But that was the primary aid to protect against nuclear flash at that time. Now, whilst Bomber Command, which became Strike Command, was responsible for maintaining the strategic nuclear deterrent pre-Polaris, a proportion of the force was held on permanent standby with weapons loaded, and a posture which was known, and I used the term earlier in the context of hunter operations, as Quick Reaction Alert, QRA. The aircraft were usually positioned on a dispersal close to the end of the runway to minimize taxiing distance and time to getting airborne, with sleeping and feeding facilities for both air and ground crews close by. I well recall that our accommodation in those very early days was in five-berth caravans, very thin aluminium walls, no privacy attached. The bunks were very, very narrow, and tall chaps like me just simply didn't have a comfortable sleeping position and regularly rolled off. And of course, in rolling off, you woke up the rest of your crew as well. But the greatest occupational hazard, I suppose, was overeating. An aircrew buffet was established on each of the V4 stations, and it was established to provide for the crews on QRA a full breakfast, a lunch, and a dinner, in addition to the in-flight packs which they made up and we carried, which were designed to ensure that those condemned to escape an evasion did so on full stomachs. But there's no doubt about it, we did grossly overeat. Coming back to the operational side of Quick Reaction Alert, the most relaxed state of readiness was termed Readiness 1-5, which meant that we were to be capable of getting airborne within 50 minutes, whatever our location on the station, and we had to stay as an element of five, a composite crew. We had our own dedicated transport. Initially, they were the somewhat unreliable Morris J2 vans, which didn't start terribly well in the winter, I remember. The next highest readiness state was 0-5, with crews actually strapped in to the cockpit with the door closed, and possibly even repositioned on the four-finger ORP, operational readiness platform, at the end of the runway. These still exist. They can be seen today. Whilst the very highest state of alert was for crews to start engines and move to the end of the runway, if not already on the ORP, awaiting only the political authorization to get airborne. In times of tension, and there were one or two, one of which I'll mention in a moment, the entire force would be put on to alert, with flights of two or four aircraft, and here I'm embracing the whole of the V-Force, including the Valiants and the Victors of three group. Flights of two or four aircraft would disperse to some 30 military and or civilian airfields throughout the UK. Our intelligence people believed that we would get a minimum of 4 minutes warning of incoming missile attack, within which time all 90 or so bombers could get airborne from those 30 runways in the time taken by just four aircraft to scramble from one airfield. And this simple but very effective plan considerably strengthened the credibility of our nuclear deterrent posture. If I could digress for just a moment, I read in the Times very recently, in connection with the Iraqi tension, that US and UK governments have threatened instant retaliation if Saddam reneges on his obligations again. But, and this was the significant point, it would be difficult for the West to maintain the constant combat readiness required for months to come. I registered surprise because, of course, we maintained just such a constant state of readiness at the height of the Cold War for many years on end. And, of course, were properly established to do so. And that, I suspect, is the difference between then and now. The crews, perhaps I could say a word about the crew. And to go back in history a little, all of the V-bombers had a five-man crew. The crew consisted of two pilots, two navigators, and a new appointment called an air electronics officer. He was concerned principally with communications and radio in the early years. The original Vulcan design catered for just one pilot, but Avro was asked to standardize by fitting two ejection seats side by side in the extremely small cockpit compared with the Valiant and the Victor, which had a very tightly curved roof. And that is why many of us who flew the Vulcan for many, many years have a virtual permanent crick in the neck. The microphone can't see what I'm doing, but the head was either that way to the left or that way to the right to cater for the combing. In consequence of this, the usual requirement for pilots to wear protective bone domes, protective helmets, was later relaxed. And because there just wasn't sufficient headroom to wear the bone dome as well, given the tight curvature. And these bone domes were donned only in emergencies or when ejection seemed possible. The crews usually formed up at the conversion unit, and mine was no exception in the case of the Vulcan. And ideally, it would remain as a cohesive unit for the entire duration of the tour. The tour length was usually about 3 years. Early weeks on the squadron were spent consolidating aircraft and systems handling and practicing airborne navigation, bombing, communications, and the electronic defense procedures until it reached a standard when it was declared combat ready. Now, from that point on, with a combat status, constituted crews spent a great deal of time locked in windowless rooms on target study, something we alluded to in the context of the Valiant, where I couldn't elaborate too much. But now we spent a lot of time in these target study rooms on material prepared for our war missions. Nominated targets were within certain countries of the old Warsaw Pact, and contrary to much speculation, they were not one-way missions. In essence, there were two plans. I must still remain somewhat guarded, but in essence, one was NATO-generated, when bomber or strike command's missions would be integrated with and deconflicted from other strike forces operating under NATO aegis, and the other plan was a purely national effort. Each crew would be required to study perhaps five NATO developed targets and two national ones, and to be extremely familiar with those targets designated as primary, to the extent, if all aids failed, of hopefully finding one's way to the target and releasing in the area, the specific area of the target. Much of this specialist and very sensitive indoctrination was completed when rostered for quick reaction alert. One had to fill the time somehow, and that was a very good opportunity. It was complemented by ever more demanding flying and ground training for the entire crew, whilst the pilots spent many additional hours rehearsing procedures and emergency drills in the flight simulator. To maintain an individual combat rating, all elements of the crew had to complete a minimum number of exercises pertinent to their specialization, whilst the crew category, the collective category, reflected the qualitative achievements of the team performing as an entity. The progression to the highest category of select star was through combat, combat star, select, to ultimately select star. And the training period was one of 6 months duration, and so the earliest one could achieve select star, the highest category, would be within 2 years and a bit of joining the squadron.
This is sort of effective disqualification.
Yes, that's right. Yes, indeed.
And they were particularly matched to more difficult targets, the more qualified ones?
Certainly. I can only presume there was some association. But again, of course, we, the humble crews, had no idea how the overall plan was constructed, but I suspect there was an element of that. We certainly could be expected to perform to a much higher standard all round than the basic combat-ready crew. And that, of course, was the great aspiration at that time, to become select star. Both pilots, in addition to these individual and collective categories, were required to be instrument rated, and latterly to hold what was called a procedural endorsement to that instrument rating in order to conform to civil requirements when flying along airways on overseas flights. Because when we did detach overseas, we invariably flew along the civil airway structure. Carrying a full fuel load, perhaps supplemented by bomb bay tanks, these were introduced progressively, together with either practice bombs or what was termed a nuclear weapons response simulator, and I could perhaps elaborate on that later if you wished, the all-up weight for a typical training profile would be about 195,000 pounds. On a typical profile, a training profile, a double engine failure might be simulated initially, followed by a heavyweight circuit, usually an instrument approach aid would be flown, and then an overshoot before climbing to a cruising level of about 40,000 feet. A navigation stage of perhaps 800 miles in length, and perhaps again using degraded navigational aids called limited nav aids, and timed to terminate at a specific point, would be followed by a descent to low level, when up to 3 simulated bombing attacks might be made. If not radar scored, accuracy could be measured using the internal F-95 camera. At any time up to this point, the aircraft might be bounced by one or more fighter aircraft at high or low level when evasive maneuvers and or electronic countermeasures would be employed. In-flight emergencies, such as an engine failure at low level following a bird strike leading to a practice diversion, would also be practiced. And on recovery to base, it was usual to complete a variety of instrument or visual approaches, again with simulated or actual multiple system failures. So that is roughly what a training sortie might be expected to embrace. I can go on to say a little bit more about the environment in which we trained, if that would be of some interest.
This is all useful.
Is it?
Yes.
Is it? Right.
If you've got the Larynx part.
Well, let's go on till I drop then. whilst most aspects of training could be completed within the UK airspace, and there were at that time, perhaps not all at the same time, conventional offshore bombing ranges for conventional bombing releases at Holbeach, Wainfleet, Thedlethorpe, Cowden, Jerby, the Isle of Man, and West Frew in West Scotland, whilst a number of inland radar bomb score units tracked our nuclear release procedures. We were, nonetheless, despite these national facilities, we were frequently detached overseas. Individual crews would be tasked on what were called Lone Rangers, or Goose Rangers, which by definition was to Goose Bay in Canada. Western Rangers, which were usually to Nebraska, to Omaha, the home of Strategic Air Command. And Pacific Rangers, when those same rangers would extend through to Hawaii. and where the facilities, especially in Canada and the USA, allowed more realistic training than we're able to get here, usually because environmental constraints on both noise and low flying were less stringent. Periodically, entire squadrons would detach overseas, typically to Malta or to Cyprus or even further afield to engage in conventional bombing or air defence exercises with Allied air forces. More difficult to achieve was comprehensive electronic warfare or countermeasures training because of the interference caused to non-military flying. I remember only two such exercises in my early days. They were both scheduled on a Saturday morning, which was not popular with the crews. They were called, if I remember, Matador and Mastodon, and the Ministry of Defence had prearranged with the civil authorities that civil flying on those two Saturday mornings would be minimised, I know not at what cost, in order that we could gain the most realistic level of training possible. A restricted national facility for such training was later developed at Spade Adam in the north of England, whilst participation in the American Red Flag exercises at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada allowed virtually unrestricted operation of all penetration aids when operating at ultra-low level. That's the second time I've used that term, usually defined as about 100 feet, which is the minimum we're allowed to go. I should have said perhaps that our introduction to low-level flying was at 500 feet by day and 1,000 feet by night. And later on, as the aids became more sophisticated, we were cleared to progressively lower levels, again linked to the crew classification on which we touched a moment ago, to 300 or even 250. And one had to have special clearance to fly at ultra-low level, and the crews pre-selected for Red Flag did engage in a period of training in the UK and had to satisfy their masters that they were fit and safe to do this before they were detached.
Just interrupting you a second, on electronic countermeasures, you're essentially sending out signals that jam enemy radars and communications.
Yes, essentially that. That was using the ether. There was another basic aid, developed, of course, in World War II, and that was to use chaff or window.
Still used it?
We were still using it at that time, yes, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if it weren't still used today.
The aluminium foil?
Yes, essentially so. Cut to various lengths to combat the various frequency spectra that we would expect to be used, either by the ground radars or by the in-flight airborne interception radars.
Mm. Now, your ultra-low-level penetration at what, 100 feet?
Yes.
You'd release a weapon at that height?
There were a variety of weapon release modes, depending very much on the weapon that one was using. The weapon I'm now talking about was the retarded weapon, the WE-177, which was introduced downstream. It wasn't available, as I intimated just now, when I first started to fly Vulcans. When I returned, that weapon was then in the infantry. One could release the retarded weapon at a very low level, depending on what result one wanted to achieve. There were varieties of that weapon as well. The yield, I won't say it was variable, but various yields could be presented within the one bomb frame. If it were deemed not sensible or safe to release at ultra-low level, there were a variety of manoeuvres that could be carried out. Toss bombing, that was a phrase that used to be used generally, more often associated with fighter bombers. The old camera used to do a labs attack. The V-bombers didn't do labs attack, but they did do what were termed pop-up manoeuvres, whereby they would penetrate at low level, and at an appropriate point prior to the release point, they would pull up into an extreme climb and release the weapon at some predetermined point in that climb, before then completing an escape maneuver and returning along the track which had been used on the penetration. that was not favoured, the preferred method was to overfly the target and lay down the weapon. The retarded weapon was sometimes referred to as the lay down weapon, as to continue and escape on the penetration heading.
So it would explode actually on the ground then?
There were options for airburst or groundburst, depending.
100 feet.
I won't elaborate on that. All I will say, the weapon could be set to operate in an airburst mode or a groundburst mode. And if indeed it had been set to operate in an airburst mode and the internal mechanics of the weapon had failed, it would then perhaps detonate on hitting the ground.
And it has a delayed action fuse, presumably, to get you out of the way.
And the parachute, of course, was the primary aid.
Mm. Mm.
Yes. We were trained to operate with highly degraded systems. I hesitate to say, in this semi-public way, of course, unlike the Americans, but for reasons which will become obvious as I go along, we did have to train with systems which could be highly degraded. They were termed secondary and tertiary aids. The most basic, of course, being the STARS and what we termed the Mark I eyeball. We would fly a navigation profile, as I mentioned just now, with the majority of our primary systems turned off, using the very basic of systems, doing astro navigation by day using the sun, and by night, of course, using the STARS. And as far as weapon release was concerned, at low level, I perfected the technique of calibrating the flight refueling probe at low level, if one's flying at a particular height. I would wait until the target, which I hopefully had visually acquired, would reach the end of the probe, and then I would have calibrated the probe length, depending on the speed we were flying at that height, and I think, well, that's about the release point when it gets on that paint scratch.
You actually did a paint mark on it?
Well, I mean, I would calibrate this by eye, yeah, in a proportion of the length, and say, right, and release the weapon. But the weapon could be released, provided the rear crew had given me the authority to release, because the two-man concept still worked even in the air. I had control of the ultimate release, provided I had been given it by the rear crew.
So he's got a switch in series with yours?
Yes, indeed, very much so, yes. And that was very much part of our training, indoctrination. Could I interrupt? The phone is ringing.
Okay.
I spent a little while talking just now about QRA, and scrambling and the readiness states and the like. Actual scrambles of unarmed aircraft were frequently ordered on exercises, but invariably in daylight, until on one occasion when dispersed to a naval air station, Broadie in Wales, I was instructed to get my flight airborne in the middle of the night. Now, that would have been fine, except that the duty air traffic matelot remained asleep throughout and failed to turn on the runway lights. So I led my my formation down a darkened runway. Scrambles were also demonstrated at air shows when four aircraft parked on the end of the runway on that ORP would be ordered to start engines from cold and to get airborne using a communication system known as telescramble. The bomber controller at High Wycombe would be the man initiating the scramble in those circumstances. And against the yardstick of that four-minute warning, which I mentioned, the fourth aircraft would regularly lift off in under 1.5 minutes. That was a truly impressive sight for the spectators, and I can promise you it really got the adrenaline moving inside the aircraft.
And that was running up four engines simultaneously.
Yes, that's absolutely right, using what was called a simultaneous start trolley.
That was a very heavily electrical.
Very much so, a great bank of batteries. And the ground crew would be standing by the aircraft as the crew approached. And given the thumbs up, they would initiate the scramble. The pilot would open the captain, would open the door, clamber up the ladder, get in. His first action would be to open up the fuel system, because the engines were now spooling up, and hopefully they would then catch, the fuel would be turned on sufficient time, jump in the aircraft, strap in, and away. I should say, for the demonstration scrambles, we would usually be pre-positioned in the aircraft and strapped in. So we saved a little bit of time there for demonstration purposes.